This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, the Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on these websites and at affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and indeed we are today talking to Martin Burt, who is the executive director of Fundación Paraguaya and a number of other things you're going to hear about. So good to be in Asunción with you, Martin.
Well, good morning. It's fantastic to receive and host American leaders, visionary, progressive leaders who are interested, just like us, on how the rest lives. And just like you at our nonprofit organization in Paraguay, in the middle of South America, we are committed to poverty elimination, and we are deploying different types of strategies that can liberate and unleash the trapped energy that everybody, including the homeless, including the have-nots, including the people who have never had a chance, including the incarcerated or the formerly incarcerated. Everybody has dignity, and everybody has a place where they can flourish.
We have so many things we can talk about: the agri high schools, the microfinance, and the stoplight program. Where do we start?
Let's start with the poverty stoplight.
Poverty stoplight. I was going to suggest that as well, because this is not just a Paraguayan program. This has become a global program. Dr. Burt, tell us, how does the stoplight work?
Well, the main question is, who owns poverty? When President Johnson in the United States launched the war on poverty, they asked a famous lady called Molly Orshansky to define what poverty meant, and she said it is the amount of money that a family needs to buy a basket of food. And so the poverty line was invented, and it became generalized throughout the world. And so poverty, for simplicity and practical reasons, was reduced to having or not having enough money. That is a great advance compared to a time where people didn't know how to define it and what to do about poverty. But now that we have technology, now that everybody has a smartphone and internet and Facebook, we know that we can move beyond trying to understand monetary poverty, and we can go to something called multidimensional poverty, which is not only lack of income, but lack of proper housing, lack of proper transportation, lack of proper education.
Access to health is important.
Health, and also you have a whole bunch of subjective indicators that are very difficult to measure. Self-esteem, violence, entrepreneurial spirit. So how do you measure that in an objective way when they are intrinsically subjective indicators? We have found that if you have the government measuring people, you get certain types of information. But if you ask the people, if you ask the heads of households to define their own poverty, then you get a more realistic appreciation of what every family's blessings are and what every family's deprivations are. From the bottom up. And it used to be very complicated to be able to identify the unique circumstances that affect each family. As Leo Tolstoy said in his novel Anna Karenina, all happy families are alike, and each unhappy family is unhappy in their own way. Well, each of us is poor in our own way. So it's not us, the non-poor, and them, or they, the poor. We're all in this. And so making poverty universal is important. Allowing the poor and everybody to measure their own poverty is very important. And allowing the coexistence of objective indicators and subjective indicators is very important. Let's say an employee of a famous supermarket in the United States.
Like Walmart.
Let's say Walmart.
Broadcast in Arkansas, let's just use that.
Exactly. So there's a big debate over whether they pay low wages or high wages.
Sure.
What we are saying is it is not enough to look at the wages. Because how many people are being supported by that wage? If you have a single mother with three children is one thing. If you have one young person with that salary for herself, that is another thing. And in addition to that, what about commuting? What about housing? So income is an incomplete measure of well-being. And we are exploring ways in different countries, in the United States, in England, in Africa, different African countries, Latin America, and Asia, to define what is poverty, what is non-poverty, what happens when people overcome poverty, where do they go? Do they go to the middle class? If you are poor in income, but non-poor, and if you're doing well in transportation and in health and in housing, are you poor? What about the opposite? Let's say that you are not making enough money, but you do have other strengths and weaknesses. So in any case, to make a long story short, we have developed a new poverty measurement tool called the Poverty Stoplight that instead of aggregating data, like poverty indexes, we disaggregate data and into 50 small, understandable, achievable, and actionable indicators. And we allow people to create a customized household and family plan to overcome it. We also, in every community where we work, we allow people to tell us what does it mean to be not poor. So in New Orleans, there is a New Orleans or a Little Rock definition of what it means to be non-poor. They know, and it varies from city to city. And also, we develop an inventory of proven successful strategies so that people can access those, because there are poor people in Bogota, Colombia, who have wheelchairs, and there are others who don't. There are deprived families in Chile who have successfully overcome their deprivations, and then there are those who haven't. So how do you provide access and skills to people? There is a very famous psychologist at Stanford University called Albert Bandura, and he talks about agency and self-efficacy. And he says that for people to change, they have to answer yes to two questions. Is it worth it? And can I do it? So is it worth it has to do with motivation. Can I do it has to do with skills. So
and agency, yes.
And agency. So
basically, whether or not you're allowed to act autonomously.
Completely. So what we are saying is that we should continue to seek the structural barriers that prevent people from flourishing, from being who they can or they want to be. But we also have to empower people. Because or else we have the opposite. You have a powerful government and a powerful structure, maybe even with good intentions. But if you have a disempowered community, then
we all know where the road to good intentions is paved to.
Exactly.
And it's not the outer poverty.
Yeah. Right. And so what have we learned?
The stoplight, yeah, don't forget, is red, yellow, and green.
Exactly.
That's the magic
so,
of it.
Exactly.
I don't want you to forget how it really works.
Why do we call it the poverty stoplight? Because we use a visual survey with illustrations depicting a non-deprived condition, a deprived condition, and a very deprived. So you can be green in income, yellow in credit, red in over-indebtedness. You may have your driver's license in good shape, so you are green in driver's license, but you have to commute 3 hours to and from work, so you are yellow in commuting, and you do have a serious problem with violence in your house, so you are red. And the thing is to allow people to take stock on, well, as the saying says, count your blessings, because if you don't count your blessings, they don't count. But having people understand, why is it that I'm always stuck in debt? And why is it that I have to put up with this type of menial work? And what we are very happy is that we have partners in a small nonprofit organization in New Orleans called Roots of Renewal, who is working with formerly incarcerated youth so that they can get training. They are building homes and rebuilding homes, and they are getting training to be able to be absorbed by labor unions later on in the construction business. We are working with Chemung County in upstate New York. There's a different types of poverty up there in Appalachia. And then we're working also with the city of Stockton in California, with Stanislaus County and Modesto in California. We just signed an agreement with the Salvation Army in Southern California and the University of California, Irvine, to try to understand how can we reach the homeless or the undocumented worker or the poor family in South Stockton and empower them so that they can act upon their problems and also demand better services from the authorities from a position of understanding what the situation is.
In talking earlier last week with Dr. Burke, you explained that in many cases your partners or in Paraguay your microfinance people sit with people as they do these interviews, and then there are repeated visits sometimes year to year. People make an individual out-of-poverty plan, let's call it. I don't know what your terminology is, but that's part of how this tool works.
Right. So the poverty stoplight is a new poverty measurement tool and a coaching methodology that allows families to reflect upon their situation with the help of an experienced caseworker, a social worker, a mentor, a coach, and to try to understand, okay, where do I start? Do I start having a family budget? Do I start going to the gym? Do I start trying to find members of my family with whom I haven't been in touch with for a long time? The issue is empowering and also increasing the social capital. What we have found is the poorer the family is, the less contacts they have and the less networks they belong to. A successful middle-class person will have a group of a high school reunion, a college reunion, a church. They will have a union. They will have different networks to be able to get information from.
Something besides Facebook.
Exactly. And what you have is the many poor families, one of their problems is isolation. So they don't even have information. And one of the things that we want to do with the poverty stoplight is change the narrative of poverty. Instead of only having and relying exclusively on the government's measuring poverty, allow the poor people to measure their poverty. And don't tell me it's too complicated, because it's no longer complicated, because now that we have smartphones and technology, you can have customization for every family. And no, it is not difficult at all.
We visited, we had the opportunity after meeting with you to visit Cerrito and the San Francisco High School, which is a Agri High School. I forget exactly the term, but it was a fascinating experiment that you put together. And you were mentioning right before I turned on the mic that in the community of Cerrito, not only you're going to combine not only the high school and all the work the Fundación is doing there, but also the poverty stoplight. And I think you wildly said you're now committed in the Fundación to eliminate poverty in El Cerrito. What in the world?
Right, exactly. I'll tell you why. We use the word poverty elimination because if you disaggregate poverty, let's take a corn kernel, a corn cob. You can't swallow the cob, but the kernels, if you disaggregate poverty into small, achievable, understandable, and actionable indicators, when you solve that problem has been eliminated for you. So the way we frame it is poverty elimination is possible, A, if you use as a unit of analysis, not the individual, but the family household, B, if you disaggregate poverty, move beyond monetary poverty and income poverty and into small pieces, and when you are green in everything, then poverty has been eliminated. It doesn't mean that you're rich, but you do no longer have deprivations that were characterizing poverty.
Tell people what you do in this high school, though.
Well,
because that's
also
part of the Cerrito plan.
Exactly. So the problem with technical vocational, going back, it's no longer a problem of access to education. It's a problem of quality. And the problem with technical vocational trade schools,
where they still exist.
Where they still exist, yeah.
Rare in the
okay.
United States.
That's very unfortunate.
Yeah.
The problem is, how do you have quality trade schools or quality technical vocational schools? It's very expensive. So what we are seeking is to find a model whereby education pays for itself. And this goes hand in hand with the need of revamping the traditional technical vocational education and incorporating entrepreneurship in it. Because today, to be a successful carpenter, at least in this part of the world, you no longer, not only do you know how to use a hammer and nails and a saw, you need to know how to create a website. You need to go and how to do direct marketing. You need to be able to communicate with your customers in a direct way, or else you will only be a blue-collar dependent on a big machinery. So how do you empower workers with, there's a time to work in the shop and there's a time to have your own shop. In any case, what we're doing is, in this part of the world, there are many types of technical vocational high schools. We have one that is agricultural. And in addition
and
to and hotel and rural tourism, there are the jobs now are in the service industry, so anybody can benefit from getting into the hospitality industry. So basically, that school charges at a year the equivalent of 1 month's minimum salary. So what you have here is we charge $400 a year. Many people think that it is what we charge every month. It's actually 1 year divided by 12, it's $40. And the rest of the money comes from a model that is learning by doing, selling, and making a profit. So you have the poultry class with
you had cattle. You had rabbits. You had
goats.
Chickens. You had goats.
Forestry.
You had bees. I mean, that was
a
menagerie there.
Right. And so those 15 small businesses on campus cover all the operational costs of the school. And students who participate in the bee operation, in the rabbit operation, in the hotel, in the cheese factory, they see how profit is made. Because the problem is with many technical vocational schools that they go back and in the back of their mind they say, oh, I'm never going to be able to break even with this because this is all subsidized. So working in a non-subsidized operation, you have the poultry class in the the poultry class in the classroom. Then you have the chicken coop where students practice. Then they have to go to the town and sell the chicken. And then they have to calculate the profit. After 3 years of rotating from the eucalyptus forest plantation to the cheese factory, to the hotel, to the chicken coop, to the organic vegetable garden, these young teenagers have a pretty good idea of what they're going to do when they return to the family farm, and what are they going to do in case they want to attend higher education in college.
We're talking to Dr. Martin Burt, who's the head of Fundación Paguea, which is a huge nonprofit with many things under its wings, including the high school and the poverty stoplight. Martin, in this period of such global inequality, and that's the United States, that's Paraguay, that's so many places where you're working, what kind of an anachronism are people like you and I and the Fundación in trying to deal with poverty? Are we just on the wrong side of the divide here? Because it looks like as the gap gets wider and some people only focus on how many billions or millions they might have, you and I are having a conversation not many people have, I don't think.
Tell me I'm wrong. You participated in the civil rights movement in the United States, and I suffered under the military dictatorship in South America. And I know the value of democracy. And I am in favor of a market economy. So, however, a market economy and a democracy is based on shared prosperity. And if there is
a problem,
we have a very serious problem because you have a mechanism here whereby the economy does really well. The economy does really well. The wealth of the nation is improving, but not the wealth of the nationals.
We've discovered some way to have a trickle-up economy.
And it is a problem that will bring to instability.
Right.
And so in the United States, the New Deal was based upon a very serious abuse of power by strong capitalist forces. The crash of the Great Depression, 1929, was created by abuse. And then we had this thing recently again in 2008.
Absolutely.
And so
which impacted your economy.
Everybody.
As well.
So I think that big business has to be trusted but verified. I think that prosperity has to be shared. And it's not going to work. We know how, we've seen this movie before. We know the ending of this movie. There will be instability on the right and on the left.
And we're seeing that.
And
world.
So there have to be structural adjustments in favor of the poor. And you cannot have a system whereby the poor in California cannot have decent, affordable housing. What happened to the American dream? The dream of suburbia in the 1950s was created with this thing in mind. And so what happened
to... You have prices that are selling for an average of way over $1 billion.
So it doesn't make sense. So I think that there has to be a housing revolution. There has to be a movement of people that have to say, we need to be able to spend 30%, 35% of our income in housing in order to have a 30-year mortgage. But what is this thing that we are... Our wages are, let's say, $15 a day, an hour. Let's say that's it. But even that is completely...
That's still hardly $30,000 a year if you work full-time, 2,000
exactly,
hours.
Exactly. So let's say that with that $30,000, you could have an affordable house and you could send your children to a good school. Everybody used to make $30,000. The thing is, the selfish prosperity versus the shared prosperity. And we know where this is going to go.
I was reading a book about how these tech billionaires now are trying to argue their revolutionaries bringing their version of social change. Let me ask you a personal question.
Yeah.
We didn't realize when we were talking last week until you sort of dropped a hint in the discussion. At one point, you were mayor of this fine city, Asuncion, and now you're running this giant nonprofit. You can compare the two jobs. Which one had more impact on this issue of dealing with poverty?
Very good. So I was elected.
That's a fair question.
No. I was elected mayor for the opposition party against the national government in 1996. The dictatorship was overthrown in 1989. The constitution was changed in 1991 so that we could elect.
The ink was hardly dry.
Oh, yeah, completely. The blood was.
And
so I ran against the government and I won. And basically, my job, my vision was to help inhabitants become citizens. Because with inhabitants, they're treated like cattle. And with citizens who know their rights and their responsibilities, they take control of the city, and you just need to put the incentives on. We created a very successful special projects fund, which is a matching fund. We told the citizens to work on any project that they wanted. If they put 50% of the money, and we would match it with 50%. Some neighborhoods...
Self-imposed tax.
Yeah. So exactly. And so some neighborhoods created parks. Another neighborhood started sports groups. Another did theater. Another did security issues. But the whole city was vibrating with their own grassroots initiatives. It was a very successful... We created 600... city groups of neighbors, all of whom were either preparing to present a project, implementing their neighborhood project, or preparing for the next one.
So now you're going to tell me you've been a community organizer.
I am.
You're carrying the title of mayor, but yeah. you're actually doing my job. It sounds
no,
like.
No. I know that the grass is always greener. So when you're mayor, you wish citizens were organized. Because what can you do with an organized citizen? Who do you talk to?
Although there are many mayors, I could start listing names who don't want
who don't want that, right? But in the microfinance program where we have been working for the past 33 years, we have organized 3,000 women's groups of around 20 to 25 members, where they.
Collectively watch their payments.
They watch their payments. They promote savings. So whenever there's a problem, they have their savings. And we have a very successful microfinance program. And we have a lot of evidence that we can help these small businesses create jobs. And we have tons and tons of... of success stories. So, what is my role? My role is to allow people to flourish. We have our organization has 500 employees. We have 24 agencies. We have
80,000 people take loans from the microfinance.
Yeah, and also we're working in 25 countries. So,
Martin, we could be here for hours talking about the Fundación. I want you to tell people who want to know more about the programs and possibly give a donation or whatever else. How do they get a hold of you? Is there a website? We only have a minute or so left, but I don't want to not say this.
Well, thank you very much. You can reach me through www.povertystoplight.org. It's a website that's in English. Also, you can just look up, you can look me up on LinkedIn, Martin Berg. You can find me there. Also, I have a Facebook page, but I have to realize that it's one of my sons who takes care of my Facebook page. But in any case, I
wonder why he's posting about every nightlife piece of things.
So what I would like to say is that we can empower youth and we can empower citizens to take control of their lives. There is nothing worse than being with a feeling of not being in control. And I want to thank you for your visit. You and your colleagues taught us a lot. We learned a huge amount
about Paraguay thanks to your help. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, and we say it on the radio. Thanking Martin Burke today. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.